Okay. Thanks, Chris, and thanks for getting a little bit of time to talk to you today. Those of you who were here Monday for Mitch's very good top 10 introduction, basically this talk fits squarely in number 9 on his top 10 list. Are disks really flat and circular? And as Mitch already pointed out to us, the answer is no. And in particular, I want to talk about warping mechanisms driven by rotating black holes or lens-Turing precession. So for anybody who hasn't seen talks by me, just to get the nomenclature, what I mean by a tilted accretion disk. So we have some accretion flow here that has some angular momentum vector tilted to the left here. And by tilted, I just mean we have a rotating black hole that has some spin axis that's not aligned with the angular momentum axis, and we'll say some tilt beta between these two. As Andrew was pointing out before, there's evidence for this, and maybe I'll get to that at the end of the talk. So in the time that I have, I want to try to point out why this is interesting, why it made Mitch's top 10 list, both from a theoretical perspective and from an observational perspective. And if I have time at the end, I'll try to make some brief arguments that such objects actually exist. Okay, so why are tilted disks around rapidly rotating black holes interesting? Well, the answer is they warp the disk, or potentially could warp the disk. How does that happen? Most of you probably know, in general relativity, rotating massive objects exert a gravitomagnetic torque. So if you have particles in orbits, this is just classic lens-Turing precession. So a particle in a tilted orbit is just going to precess around this rotating object. We have gravity probe B trying to measure this around Earth. In the case of disks, it's going to be differential lens-Turing precession. There's a strong radial dependence to the precession, so it'll be a differential precession. And it basically will lead to some sort of a warping in the disk. And so that's pretty clear and easy to understand. The question, though, is basically what happens to these warps that are generated in the disk by a rotating black hole? There's sort of two general regimes that most people consider. More common, if you have the case of a viscous, or we consider thin disks, some strong viscosity parameter or viscous coupling, then the warps are actually transported by those viscous stresses. But we can also consider a case of, say, lower viscosity, or even a limiting case of no viscosity, maybe a thick disk. In this case, viscous stresses aren't going to be effective. And so the warps, if they're going to be transported, would have to be transported by waves or other phenomena. So the first case is the one people are more familiar with. This is what leads to what's generally called the Bardeen-Pedersen effect. So just to reiterate, it's a combined result of differential lens-Turing precession and internal viscosity. And so this is my poor sketch of basically what I have in mind when you talk about a Bardeen-Pedersen effect. So there's some accretion flow coming in with some source of material that's giving it an angular momentum. In this case, I'm picturing a binary system where the material is coming from some companion star. And so the angular momentum of the outer disk is just going to be fed by the binary orbital parameter here. And then close to the black hole, we have a rotating black hole whose spin axis isn't aligned with that angular momentum of the disk. Close to the black hole, lens-Turing precession is going to be strong. In this case, if we have a viscous disk, the warps are going to be able to be transported out of this inner region. And basically, you're going to be left with the inner disk relaxing to the symmetry plane of the black hole. The outer disk, where lens-Turing precession is much weaker, isn't really going to know that there's a rotating black hole in there, so it's going to have the original orientation. And the picture I want you to keep in mind from this is, in some sense, you have an inner disk with one inclination and an outer disk with another inclination. Now, there are lots of open questions on this, just a few of which are, where does this transition radius occur? There's lots of estimates in the literature that go anywhere from a few RG, maybe 10 RG, up to hundreds of gravitational radii. Another question is, how wide is this transition? How steep is it? And then finally, what roles? Most people have done this just in estimates using alpha viscosity models, but the question is what role do magnetic fields and the MRI play here? So I've done some simulations in the case of inviscid, so that was the viscous case. The inviscid case, you don't have any explicit angular momentum transport put in, so there's no magnetic fields in this simulation, no viscosity. So the only transport mechanism is waves. And so basically I'll show a quick simulation. And I apologize, the time resolution on the movie is pretty low. So you're going to see a lot of things happen in the first couple frames, and then it just kind of settles into a quasi-steady state. But that's actually kind of the interesting result. Okay, so quickly, so I showed the black hole's tilted 15 degrees to the left here. We started with an axisymmetric torus around a vertical symmetry. And you can see basically by the end of the simulation that the disk is still trying, even though there's no viscosity in this case, it's still trying to orient itself more or less in the symmetry plane of the black hole. And basically the way it's doing this, the primary mechanism are these spiral accretion flows coming in from high latitudes towards the black hole, and that's what's transporting some of the tilted angular momentum and the twist. This has only run out, this is 10 orbits of this particular. I've run lower resolutions out to 30 orbits. The point is, you can kind of see in the movie, it's fairly steady state once you get past the first few frames, and that persists for a fairly lengthy period of time. And I don't have time, this kind of goes into it in more detail, but I don't think I have time to cover this whole slide. Because I want to switch now and get a little bit of the observational motivation for these tilted disks. So we've heard a little bit already about the diagnostic power of relativistic iron lines in disks. And the big thing I want to highlight, it's already been mentioned, these lines are sensitive to the inner edge of the accretion disk, or the inner edge of the emitting region, the outer edge of the emitting region, and the inclination. So if you go back to that picture I showed of a Bardeen-Pedersen disk, we have two disk components with different inclinations and with some transition radius, then you have all the diagnostic power in these iron lines potentially to actually detect something like this. So we've done sort of a cartoon model of this, basically putting in by hand Bardeen-Pedersen disks. And so basically we've explored this parameter space, is basically what we've done so far. So we put in some outer disk, we put in an inner disk, the two of them are inclined relative to each other. There's some transition radius that appears here. And so basically this illustrates the power of this technique in a fairly idealized way. But the point is that, for instance, in these lines, the blue wing is sensitive to the inclination of the disk relative to the observer. And so you get this complicated line profile instead of the simple two-horn peak that you expect just from normal relativistic effects. You actually get this three-horn, in this case, a three-horned structure, where this is actually the blue wing of the outer disk. This middle peak is the blue wing of the inner disk. That little peak is the red wing of the outer disk. And then there's a long red tail from the inner disk. And so the point is that this kind of these kinds of lines, if they were detected, would be maybe direct signatures of a Bardeen-Pedersen type disk. And so the thing we did basically in this paper that I just want to highlight is, in principle, this technique is sensitive to the things you would like to constrain, such as where that transition radius is. You can see the line profile varies strongly as you vary the transition radius. It's also sensitive to the tilt between the disks, okay? So again, the profile changes significantly as you vary that tilt. So basically, the two things are there to actually be able to use this to hopefully detect at some point a Bardeen-Pedersen disk directly. So marginal evidence that these actually exist in the last couple minutes that I have. Some of my favorite systems. Okay, 1 minute. So GROJ 1655-40, it's a microquasar system, fairly well-constrained inclination of the binary, and that again is going to determine the inclination of the outer disk component. It's a microquasar. In its first outburst, they saw a very nice relativistic jet that was well-constrained to lie in the plane of the sky, or more or less. And you can see these two angles aren't consistent with each other. If you believe that the jet tells you something about the spin of the black hole or the inner accretion disk, then there's some tilt between these two of order 15 degrees or more. I want to see, I guess this system's in outburst again, so it'd be interesting if another jet shows up, if they can do this again. Similar things happen in XT 1550. Again, a well-constrained inclination. Superluminal jets constrain it to the jet being coming towards us. Again, a tilt of 14 degrees or more. And other sort of just circumstantial evidence that you have these warped disks. Mitch actually showed this one. This is clearly warped, but this isn't on the scale of lens Turing. This is some other mechanism here. That can't be lens Turing out at the scales they're looking at. But precessing disk, precessing jets, jet disk misalignment, multiple emitting regions in iron K-alpha, and one of my little pet projects is trying to relate this to QPOs, which Ron just talked about. The speaker says I'm done. With the chair.
Okay, questions, comments?
Going back to the movie you showed initially, it settles down, if I understood it correctly, into a state where you have essentially two disks tilted relative to each other, more or less.
Yeah.
So the question is about the details of that configuration. How much mass is there that it's not, that is not in the in one of the two planes?
That's a good question, and I apologize. In the 10 minutes, I don't have time to talk about the simulations too much. Basically, in this case, this was a torus where most of the mass. See, the thing I didn't have time to go into that determines this. So, the waves, the warping in this case is transmitted by wave modes. And so, the thing that's important is to compare the lens Turing time scale to the sound crossing time. And so, you can see the warping is all interior to this line. Basically, the warps. This is kind of a measure of the warping. Happens in the interior of the disk, and that's basically where the lens Turing dominates over the sound speed. And then the outer part of the disk, the sound speed's shorter than the lens Turing time scale. So in this disk, most of it ends up warped because the bulk of the disk material, most of the mass of this particular disk configuration, is in the region where the lens Turing dominates. In the paper, we do other simulations where the bulk of the material is out in this region, and you actually don't get much warping. What you get is a global precession. The whole disk precesses as a single body, more or less. And people have used that to explain, for instance, variability in Sag A star and stuff.
Where I was, the next part of the question is if when you compute the profiles of emission lines, you could get contributions from material that is neither in neither of the two planes. So that may spoil the clean observational tests.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, and that's a good point to emphasize, is that that was just to, the work we've done so far is to highlight the potential power, but there are lots of things that can confuse it. Other warps would lend to other peaks showing up. Also, if there are more than one ionization state of the iron, that can confuse it. So I present a simple picture. The observers are going to recognize that all it does is add to their headache to some extent.
Does the inner disk process at all?
In this case, the inner disk doesn't because it's in the symmetry plane of the black hole. So there's no longer a torque on the inner disk. There's still a residual torque, you know, at the sort of at the transition radius is the way to think about it. And so a follow-up to that a lot of people ask is, there is some residual torque. Eventually, the system will be aligned. In the case of X-ray binaries, that alignment time scale is probably of order the observational lifetime of X-ray binaries. In AGN, I think there's still a debate as to how long they could stay in this sort of Bardeen-Pedersen configuration.
I was thinking that if there was still a torque from the outer disk on the inner disk, so that the inner disk wasn't quite aligned, then that would process around, and that would give us a QPO signature.
Yeah, actually, and even in the X-ray binary, you're right, because even the companion now will exert a torque on the inner disk, because now the companion has some effect on the inner disk. So right, there could still be a residual torque, but that would be on a much longer time scale. So I don't think it would be a QPO time scale, but long-term variability scale. There's one back there, one.
Just a quick question about these waves. You say there's only waves in here, but if that's really true and the waves are undamped, then they'll rattle around the system forever. This is probably not what you're seeing, so the actual approach to a steady state is probably still due to your numerical diffusion, isn't it?
Are there shocks?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key in this one is Yeah, is understanding, and maybe we don't fully understand, this accretion stream coming in from, I think that's what's really transferring most of the tilted material and some of the twist, and it's basically dumping it into the black hole. But yeah, and so, right, I don't know if shocks are killing off some of the waves, yeah, in the outer part of the disk, or if...
It would become important at some point to actually say something about what really causes effective viscosity in these disks.
Right.
Any more? Okay.
What in this
yes.
particular case? This
yes.
is fully relativistic hydro only in this case, and so this is. What do you mean? Okay, so this is logarithm of density. Yeah, I'm sorry, in the short talk. So, and this is log density. There's a color scale of log density sliced through the middle of it, and this is in a logarithmic radial coordinate, so it stretches everything out. So that's why the black hole looks almost as big as the torus. Well, it's basically this center region that's carved out here. So it's not, if you're in the previous picture, I sort of put a cartoon version of, I mean, that's basically the black hole. Relative to the size of this, and then it doesn't show up in this plot, but it's basically this central carved out region. Does that answer what you're trying to?